I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Michael Walzer, professor emeritus at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. We're discussing his recent book, The Struggle for a Decent Politics, on liberal as an adjective from Yale University Press. Walzer has written about a wide variety of topics in political theory and moral philosophy, including political obligation, just and unjust wars, nationalism and ethnicity, economic justice and the welfare state, and has published many influential books and articles.
Well, first of all, Michael Walzer, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
I'm very glad to be here.
I should say welcome back. It's been a couple years since our last conversation, but it's great to see you again. I love this new book of yours. Congratulations on it. It seemed to me to synthesize a lot of your insights from across your career, brought them to bear on defending liberalism at this particular junction in time, defending against the illiberalisms that are arising on both the left and the right. So congratulations on the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Well, I was inspired by two other books, which must be a common experience for writers. In 1935, Carlo Rosselli, who was the leader of the non-communist opposition to Mussolini's fascist government, he published a book called Liberal Socialism. And 2 years later, he was assassinated by Mussolini's thugs. And then a good friend of mine in Israel wrote a PhD dissertation with Isaiah Berlin, which was published as Liberal Nationalism. And I started thinking about what does the adjective do in phrases like that. And I came to believe that the adjective actually does very important work, which is especially important right now because of the rise of various forms of illiberal politics. But I should say, my book is not about liberalism, which I don't believe right now is a coherent ideology. My book is about what the adjective does to ideological positions like democracy, socialism, nationalism, communitarianism, feminism. I really am committed to the value of the adjective.
Yeah, good. Could you say a little bit more about what's deficient, I think, about liberalism, I guess, at this moment, because it's ahead.
In Europe, liberalism is essentially what we call libertarianism, but not the left libertarianism. It is a right wing kind of laissez-faire politics. In the United States, liberalism is simply our name for our very modest version of social democracy. New Deal liberalism, but many of the defenders of New Deal liberalism became defenders of neoliberalism, which is, so I don't see a coherent doctrine. It means anything from laissez-faire politics to some kind of social democracy. And I prefer just to use the term social democracy, which has actually a much more specific meaning than New Deal liberalism. And I think what the adjective does, it modifies these nouns, Democrat, socialist, nationalist, whatever. It modifies them in ways that are sometimes constraining, as when liberal democracy is a democracy where the majority cannot do anything it wants. Orban's illiberal democracy in Hungary is precisely the doctrine that once you have a majority, it can do anything. Liberal democracy implies the restraints of civil rights, of human rights. The adjective is also pluralizing. A liberal democracy is a democracy where there is more than one party, where there is a competition for power, a right of opposition. And similarly, liberal socialism denies the authority of the vanguard, the knowers of the path of history. They cannot do anything they want. They are also restrained by a commitment, in this case, to democracy and to human rights. Liberal nationalism is the recognition that even if assuming that our nationalism is legitimate, so is the nationalism of many other nations. It's the recognition of the right of self-determination, and its multiple, its pluralist outcomes, and so on. That's what the adjective does, and I think right now it is very important to focus on the value of the adjective.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I feel the force of the kind of incoherence of liberalism on the ground right now. I'm wondering about, you know, sort of liberal, the traditional liberal political philosophy, which, you know, you don't talk about Rawls in the book, but I'm just wondering if you could comment on that. I mean, at least the, you know, one perspective from that kind of tradition is to think about kind of liberalism as a moral core to politics, and it provides the kind of moral basis for thinking about politics. I'm wondering, like, on your view, does what plays the, you know, what's the basis of the moral claims that you're developing in the book? Does it come from the nouns like the socialism and the feminism and so forth, or do you see the moral core as coming from the adjective and the descriptor?
Well, the adjective carries the moral vision, the pluralizing, constraining vision of that is at the core of liberalism. I've always thought of Rawls. I guess he is often described as the classical liberal of the 20th century, but he was really a social democrat. And I think that's the best way of thinking of the work that the difference principle does. The difference principle is not inherent in any version of liberalism. It is a redistributive, it is a socialist or social democratic principle.
Yeah, I guess that's why it makes me think that you know, liberalism as a noun plays, you know, serves and does some moral work, I guess, behind any use of the adjective. Like, the adjective requires a prior appeal to liberalism as a comprehensive moral doctrine. Well, Rawls wouldn't say a comprehensive moral doctrine, but or freestanding moral doctrine, or whatever your form of liberalism, I suppose. But
no, very much a moral doctrine, but not a social economic ideology.
Yeah, that's okay. Good. That's a helpful distinction. And I want to go through some. I mean, your chapters, you sort of gave us a you know, a preview of your chapters. You talk about liberalism describing various other isms, liberal democracy, liberal socialism, liberal nationalism, and so forth. And I want to sort of talk through, you know, as many as we can in the time we have here. You start with liberal democracy, and so that's where I thought we could start. Maybe you could start by talking about democracy and what happens when the liberal adjective is not applied to it, right? What is it that can happen with democracy in your view, and what we see around us, I suppose? What is it that why is it that liberalism is needed in the case of democracy?
Well, democracy is the rule of the majority, the consent of the governed, which means the consent of the greater number of the governed. And we have seen that majorities can be can pose a great danger to human rights, to freedom, to the right of opposition. Right now, illiberal democracy is precisely a democracy that whose leaders claim that once they have secured a majority, they represent the people with a capital P, and the people can do anything, including the ensuring that the people continue to win one election after another. So the adjective liberal really does constrain that kind of majoritarianism. You can think of populism. I quote somebody saying this. You can think of populism as the triumph of majoritarian democracy over liberal constraint. And we see that in many parts of the world. Hungary is the prime example, precisely because its political leader uses the term, claims to be an illiberal Democrat. But we see the same thing in Turkey. We see the beginnings of it in Israel. We see it in Trumpism here in the United States. And all of those people claim to be, in all of those countries, the leaders of a far-right ideology claim to be Democrats speaking for the people.
Yeah, and that's good. I mean, liberal certainly constrains democracy in the sense of commitment to the rule of law and a set of rights and so forth. I'm wondering if what you make about other kind of constraints in a democracy, certainly in American constitutional tradition, like the various veto points that exist in the American constitutional system that sometimes on some views, constrains or creates too much gridlock in the political process. That sometimes political observers say we need more power to a majority, not less, not more veto points. I mean, where do you stand in terms of the sort of veto features in the American constitutionalism? Is that in your view a healthy liberal constraint, or is that something that, we can still have these kind of liberal commitments to the rule of law with fewer kinds of veto constraints?
Well, I think the checks and balances in the Constitution are well designed. The problem is that the overall system isn't well designed. We have a system in which, in fact, minorities are overrepresented, and we don't have a democratic majority because of the Senate, where two senators can represent a very small population or a huge population, and gerrymandering for the House. But if we had a properly functioning democracy, then the constraints would be needed. We would want those constraints.
A couple places in the book you contrast your view with Rousseau, and I thought you maybe you could contrast your view of liberal democracy against Rousseau, as a sort of great defender of participatory democracy, a sort of strong, full-throated, get out there and think of your citizenship as the sort of primary identity in your life. How do you distinguish your, liberal democracy from it? What are the limits of Rousseau's vision of democracy?
Well, Rousseau, vision of citizenship is exhausting. He really believes that the citizen should do, as this is a quote, everything for themselves. And therefore, he's against professional politicians. He's against representative democracy. He believes that the army should be a citizen's army. He believes, by extension, his contemporary followers believe that the police should be abolished and the citizens should police each other. Local committees, neighborhood committees should replace the police. School teachers, we don't want, according to Rousseau, professional school teachers. Elderly citizens, supposedly wise, should teach the young. There really is no time for private life, no time to sit and write poetry, no time to pursue a hobby. It is an overwhelming, as I said, exhausting theory of politics, and it doesn't work. We were very committed to participatory democracy in the 60s in the left organizations that I was part of, and what it turns out it's the participants who rule. And the participants tend to be the people who are committed to every meeting and to stay to the end of every meeting. And they just overwhelm the more ordinary participants who have jobs, families, and kids to take care of. Participatory democracy turned out to be the rule of the militants, and it wasn't democratic at all. Now, in civil society, many organizations are ruled by the people who are willing to devote time and energy to the work. Most civil society organizations are not democratic, and that's okay. But for the political system, it's not okay.
Yeah, I the other sense I got from your book is that there's a problem with the kind of democratic competence too. That is, that if the demos is trying to do all the work all the time, you miss out on the power of experts or expertise of, you know, electing particular individuals to kind of do the work that, you know, so liberalism introduces, I guess, an aristocratic element into democracy through a kind of representative institution. So, you know, to sort of correct the whatever traditional mistakes that the demos could make, right?
Right. And liberalism is again a kind of restraint, opening room for someone who wants to be a good teacher to work hard to make himself, herself a good teacher, which is not allowed by the Rousseauian communitarian or the full-fledged Rousseauian doctrine.
I wonder what you think about, you know, kind of middle ground between a Rousseau and you. I'm thinking of a political theorist at Yale named Ellen Landamore has developed a kind of a new defense of like sortition in democracy, right? So, you know, one of the problems with electing too many people into our politics is that they precisely represent, you know, the kind of rich and privileged, like the U.S. Senate is composed of majority white male, extremely rich individuals. So if we have a system of sortition, that would be kind of in the spirit of Rousseau in, you know, maximizing participation, but maybe wouldn't be as exhausting as, you know, doing it all the time. You only have to maybe like your ticket would be called only once every few years, kind of like jury duty. Do you think, more sortition? I mean, or what do you think? What would so like a liberal adjective about that have to do with sortition, you think?
I think there could be room for that in a liberal democratic system. I do value the professional politician who makes a life out of it, and who acquires some competence along the way, and establishes some long-term relationship with a constituency. But jury duty works with a system that allows a lot of exemptions. When I reached 75, I no longer had to respond to any jury calls.
We miss out on all your wisdom, Michael.
Right.
Yeah. Citizenship. I mean, you talk about citizenship a lot in the chapter. One of the things I think you wrestle with, which I was hoping you comment on here now, is the sort of civic bond that exists or should exist really in a democracy, and one that is seemingly kind of under threat in the United States today. But you say this is a quote from page 25, where you say that you hope that liberal Democrats stick with the idea that citizenship, material interest, and our modest civil religion are the best unifiers of a highly diverse political society like ours. Maybe you could elaborate on the sources of the sort of democratic unity that exists in democracies, ideally, and how much hope do you have that these bonds actually will hold the U.S. together? Yeah.
Well, the early visions of democracy were all designed for radically homogeneous societies, ethnically, religiously, with a common history. And I think it is perhaps easier to make democracy work. It's certainly easier to make social democracy work in societies of that sort, because people are more willing to commit to some kind of mutuality across the political and even the economic system. But we increasingly live in highly diverse societies where the connections are not ethnic or religious, and where people have different histories, different biographies. So what is it that holds a society like ours together? And I think it has to be a commitment to the political system. And that means a commitment to democratic citizenship. And I think that commitment needs some ritual enactments, some celebrations, like the 4th of July or Memorial Day, which bring people together outside of or over above all of their differences. So I do value the idea of a civil religion, but not one that accommodates all the real religions, but one that has serious meaning. I think it's very important that the holidays of the civil religion, the patriotic holidays, should be holidays and not vacations. I think it was a big mistake to move Memorial Day to the first Monday after whatever, because that converts a holiday into a long weekend and people go away instead of joining a communal celebration. In my hometown in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, after World War II, Memorial Day was an extraordinarily meaningful event. Everybody went to the cemetery, and there was a Protestant, a Catholic, and a Jewish rabbi, minister, priest speaking, and the mayor, who spoke, I suppose, for any atheists in the community. And it was an enormously moving occasion. As school children, we literally marched to the cemetery. So I think that is very important in keeping us a society like ours together. And we have in a way secularized the civil religion and turned it into an occasion for going away for a weekend or a lot of fireworks and no recognition of the meaning of the day.
Yeah, or it might be divisive too. I think you mentioned Stephen Smith's recent book on patriotism in your book. I mean, this is one of the points that he makes, is that something like the American flag itself has become politicized. Well, I suppose this, you mentioned the 60s, that was also a time when the American flag was politicized, but that the, you know, Trump, Trump and the Trumpians become associated with the American flag. And Stephen Smith kind of bemoans the, you know, that the sort of division among the sort of icons of American patriotism. I mean, do you have a take on, I was wondering about sort of civic education in, I have two daughters, as I mentioned before the podcast, and, you know, they go to school and they're in Texas, right? So they do the pledge, not just the Pledge of Allegiance, but the pledge of to the Texas, the Pledge of Allegiance to Texas too. So, which is quite funny, but, the University of Houston here where I teach, all students are expected to teach take two semesters of American and Texas politics as a sort of nod to a kind of development of citizenship in public universities. I mean, have you thought about this in terms of how education can play a role in the development of you know, kind of civic consciousness, and what a kind of liberal adjective with regard to civic education, what that would have to say?
Yes, I think our schools are enormously important, and they should be teaching the history of democracy, the meaning of democracy, the meaning of and the obligations and the privileges that come with citizenship. That should be an important part of the of education, certainly in our public schools, and I think a curriculum of that sort should be required in all private and parochial schools. And since in some parochial schools, courses like a course on American history is taught with a wink and a nod to the students to let them know that it isn't really important, I think we have to insist that it is important and find ways of testing and making sure that the basic courses that you need in order to function as a citizen, the basic things you need to know are actually taught and taught in a serious way. I say this in the book, we don't have an established church, but we do have an established state. And we have a right to work with the next with each new generation to sustain our political establishment. I think that's that is an important function, and we shouldn't let private religious schools off the hook. Because their kids, I mean, yes, parents have a right to educate their own children, but these children are going to grow up to vote in our elections. And so we have a right that they be educated in a way that makes them competent voters.
The your next chapter is on liberal socialism, and I wanted to turn to that. I think about it's probably clear, although feel free to sort of elaborate on this, because there's a kind of a litany of horrors that's associated with illiberal forms of socialism. But I trust that probably a lot of people are sort of familiar with the consequences of illiberal socialism. But I think maybe less clear would be the sort of character and the policies of a liberal form of socialism. I mean, you talk about social democracy and so forth, and maybe you could say a little bit about how you understand liberal socialism, how you might distinguish it from social democracy, and what its features might be.
Well, it is closely connected to liberal democracy. And which is why I prefer social democracy to socialism simply. But it is a commitment to a doctrine that the members of a political society have certain commitments to each other to ensure their freedom, their civil rights, their human rights. And their capacity to function in the society and the economy. And I think it is important to recognize that radical inequality undercuts both democracy and certainly social democracy, that there has to be, actually Rousseau makes this point, not any kind of leveling, but there has to be a certain degree of egalitarianism if the citizens are to relate to one another in the way that a common citizenship implies. And the difficulty with the work of socialism, the effort to achieve a greater, less inequality or more equality, that effort has been associated in many countries, in many periods of time, has been associated with the work of a vanguard, which claims not to represent the people as they are, but the people as they should be, or one day will be when we reach the goal. And vanguard politics has been a feature of socialist endeavor. And I think liberal socialism or social democracy, it represents a rejection of the vanguard and a claim that the struggle to achieve a more egalitarian society has to be fought within the limits of a liberal democratic order.
Yes. So what do you say to sort of, Marxian inspired objections to that kind of view that, if you're going to admit things like private property and meritocratic, appeals into a socialist, all socialist ideals or aims. It's, this is, we're not going to see serious or significant progress towards those ideals, but a kind of, maintenance of a kind of structural status quo, that there are kinds of structural inequalities that are difficult to be overcome through a kind of, progressive or
reform.
Incremental reform. Yeah.
Yes. Well, that is a real argument. The structures of inequality are very strong, and the argument of the farther left is that only a dictatorship of some sort, a dictatorship of the proletariat, a democratic dictatorship, can overcome, can break through those structures, restructure a society. And that's an argument that we have to, liberal socialists have to address. The glory years of social democracy after 1945 are examples of quite radical transformations. Clement Attlee and his Labour Party did in 1945 to 48 in England was a radical transformation. And you have to recognize, well, the war helped make it possible. Austerity helped make it possible, I guess. But still, it was a political struggle and with quite remarkable results. And I have come to value certain kinds of victories, which are underestimated, I think, by the farther left. In my hometown was Johnstown, Pennsylvania. It was a steel town, Bethlehem Steel. It was a company town, and Bethlehem Steel was the company. The little steel strike of 1937 was broken in Johnstown when the steel company brought in vigilantes. And the mayor and the city council, who were literally in the pay of the steel company, worked to overcome, to defeat the strike. And then in 1941, the National Labor Relations Board, the great instrument of New Deal politics, brought the union. They organized a vote, and the steelworkers union won by a 4-1 margin. And the union came to Johnstown. And it made a big difference. And people don't remember what a difference it made. Suddenly, the steelworkers had more money. They became consumers. And I think that creation is radically under, the value of that is radically underestimated on the farther left. But they not only became consumers, they became citizens of the city, and all of the mayor and his officers and all of the civil servants in the city suddenly became more civil to people to whom they'd never been civil before. And the atmosphere, the feel of the city changed. So victories like that are possible. And if you multiply victories like that, you get a much better society. And long ago, I wrote a book on the Exodus, the book of Exodus in the Bible, which describes the march from pharaonic servitude to the promised land. And I turned this into a social democratic story, which some theologians thought was unjustified. But the promised land wasn't a messianic paradise. The promised land was just a better place than Egypt was. And that is, it took a march. It took 40 years.
But yeah, no, Kant says it could take 1,000 to get to, you know, perpetual peace.
Yes. So we need to keep that perspective, to keep that possibility alive.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I wanted to ask maybe more specific version of this question, because you take up civil disobedience in the book at one point. I guess the question is, does a liberal have a particular stance on the use of force or violence to affect political change, right? I mean, so, you know, sometimes the further left says, right, in order to break through these structures of inequality, sometimes you need to riot or, you know, otherwise use force or violence. I mean, is it the liberal view that, you know, force and violence are never the answer? And if so, why?
Well, never say never. certainly imagine situations where the use of force a slave rebellion, say. But if you live in, as we do, of a democracy, however flawed it is, then I think you have to be committed to a nonviolent politics. And that doesn't mean obedient. It doesn't mean a politics that has no weapons, but the weapons are the weapons of the strike, the general strike, civil disobedience, massive demonstrations and marches. I think that there's quite a lot of evidence that useful progress that actually makes lives better, is more often achieved by methods that are not violent, and certainly by methods that are not terrorist. I mean, the argument for terrorism is exactly the argument you made. It's the we tried everything else, which mostly terrorists never did. And this is a last resort because the system is so powerful that all we can do to challenge it is this kind of random killing, which would drive the government to make changes. It's not a way to achieve democracy because I quote in the book, and I've quoted in several books, that wonderful line from Trotsky that terrorism, what is, now I've lost it. Terrorists are, the gist of it is that terrorism is the work of an elite who want to make the people happy without the participation of the people. That's the line. Terrorism is a politics that aims to make people happy without their participation. And when it wins, when the terrorists win, as in Algeria, I guess, they produce a government of the terrorist elite, of the they produce an authoritarian regime because they didn't follow a politics that leads to democracy, a politics of mass, of organized protests, the politics of demonstrations, of general strikes, et cetera. I think of that kind, that's a democracy inducing or democracy leading politics.
Right, yeah. I wanted to ask you about liberal nationalism, which is the next chapter of the book, liberal nationalism and internationalism. And it's, you know, again, a helpful frame in terms of thinking about nationalism, which can have in its illiberal forms that are probably familiar to us from, say, the Trumpian nationalism of recent years to, say, Hungary and Orban, sort of illiberal forms of nationalism there. But, you know, it's surprising to see you defend a kind of a liberal form of nationalism. It may seem like a kind of contradiction in terms. So maybe you could say a little bit about what a liberal form of nationalism would look like or what it would involve.
It, you might say it's the original form. Mazzini was the first liberal nationalist and probably the first theorist of nationalism. And he founded Young Italy, which was an organization working to create an independent Italian state. But then he also helped to found Young Germany, Young Poland, Young Switzerland, indicating that he was a pluralist. He believed that the right of national self-determination was the right of every nation. And that what makes a liberal nationalist is a recognition of the other nationalisms. And the test The test of a liberal nationalist is the nation that comes next. So the test of Turkish nationalism is the Kurds. The test of Chinese nationalism is the Tibetans. The test of Israeli or Jewish nationalism is the Palestinians. If you are able to acknowledge the meaning of national emotion, national sentiment, national commitments in other people, then you are a liberal nationalist.
Right. I think in the German tradition, which I'm familiar with, Johann Gottfried Herder talks about, you know, the nations of the world. He's a kind of liberal nationalist too. The nations of the world making up a beautiful garden, right? Different nations are like different kinds of growths of humanity that have different kind of distinctive.
Right. The usual metaphor is the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
I am critical of because orchestras generally have tyrannical conductors. I mean, good orchestras generally have tyrannical conductors, so it's not a useful image for a liberal.
Yeah, well, I like the garden because sometimes, you know, he develops it, you know, there can be weeds that grow, and those are the illiberal forms of nationalism that try to take over the other parts of the garden. So yeah. It's the sort of liberal nationalists that, you know, blossom in their own particular spot and allow the others to blossom too. I was curious about, you know, sort of the balance of thinking about national self-determination against the kind of internationalism, because you're not, you know, there are obviously in sort of the economic domain, there's a question about, you know, national sort of protective tariffs and whatnot, or a kind of globalist sort of free trade. That would be one question as to how a liberal would balance those two commitments. I mean, there's the question of government, you know, global governance, you know, how much you mentioned Brexit at one point. I mean, what's a liberal take on sort of international institutions versus national self-government? And I think of war too. I mean, war, you know, in the context of war, what's a liberal take on a kind of, you know, national, letting nations develop on their own versus a kind of internationalist interventionist take on things. So how does a liberal sort of balance, I guess, the national self-determination, sort of global turn to a kind of global community?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish cosmopolitanism from internationalism. Cosmopolitanism, it's mostly a philosophical doctrine, but it holds that there shouldn't be any borders, that we are citizens of the world. Whereas internationalism implies cooperation across borders. Internationalism implies the existence of nations that interact in certain ways. One of the forms of interaction can be a federal arrangement, as in the EU. And other forms of interaction might include security alliances like NATO, or economic cooperation, as in the first version of the EU. But all of these versions recognize the right of self-determination for the peoples who are part of these systems, and the value of the EU as an experiment is precisely that it is trying to suggest that you can combine local, national self-determination of the French and the Germans and the Italians and the Poles. You can combine that with a European self-determination. And that requires the constitutional arrangements and probably a long period of conflict to sort things out. Brexit was a refusal to be part of this kind of double, you're a citizen of Europe and a citizen of Britain. And they were unwilling to recognize, I think, the great value of a dual citizenship of that kind. Internationalism, also in its early socialist version, does imply that if there is a tyrannical dictatorship in a country, if there is the persecution of minorities, if there are massacres going on, that we should contemplate different forms of intervention, that we do have obligations across borders, but only obligations to intervene only in fairly extreme cases.
Do you see any kind of trade-offs between internationalism and nationalism? I'm thinking again of the Brexit case, and to sort of inhabit that argument there for a second. I mean, the worry that the long march towards international governance and institutions and the self-determination of Europe might come at the cost of the kind of effacement of British national self-determination and the kind of loss of a certain set of culture and political history that's characteristic of Great Britain, that there is a trade-off. In other words, that it's difficult to maintain, I think, both unity and difference in these institutions.
Well, it might be a trade-off, but if you think about something like what some of the Brexiteers most objected to, that is a European court of human rights. I don't think you're losing much of English culture if you recognize a court of human rights. The immigration question is harder. There were 1 million Poles living in England at the time of the Brexit controversy. And it was very unclear to me, at any rate, just exactly what their status was. Were they still Polish citizens? Did they vote in Poland for a government that wouldn't be governing them? Whereas in Britain, they couldn't vote for a government that would be governing them. That has to be figured out. And it may be that you need pan-European elections and local elections. I'm not sure exactly how it would work, but the open borders does raise the question of how you sustain a democracy, since democracy is the self-government of the governed. And if you have large numbers of people who are being governed but aren't part of the political, have no political rights. So that's the problem that the EU has to solve. And I suspect that one of the solutions is going to be some limit on immigration across the borders of the internal borders of the EU.
Liberal communitarianism is the next, which you've written a lot about. Illiberal communitarianism, you take aim here at Rousseau, which is kind of a helpful foil in thinking about Rousseau's government of Poland, for example, as an anti-pluralist. I mean, wants to sort of homogenize a sense of community. Whereas you're more on the Tocqueville side. I mean, maybe you could say, if you want to say about, Tocqueville's vision of civil society and the kind of, wonder that he has about American civil society and the many associations that individuals belong to. Is that the vision of kind of liberal communitarianism that you have in mind?
Yes, I think the communitarianism can be a description of the Rousseauian Republic, or it can be a description of a liberal democratic society within which there are a large number of communities, overlapping communities, but communities where people can find some of the intensity that Rousseau's that Rousseau's community is supposed to produce. And I think liberal communitarianism implies the a plurality of communities within some kind of democratic framework. And that's my own, my own community. I mean, I am a communitarian, but
Yeah, folks can read Spheres of Justice if they haven't, like me, read it 20 times already. So they want the fuller picture. Let me just then ask you the atomism kind of question or worry with the, you know, to return you to the communitarian liberal debate. I mean, which like some of this, I mean, isn't it the case that liberalism is in some sense in tension with community? You say on page 5 of the book that liberal as an adjective constrains the use of force and makes for pluralism, skepticism, and irony. Those last two words, skepticism and irony, kind of stuck out to me, because isn't it when liberal modifies a people and it injects more skepticism and irony in a people, don't people then come to become more skeptical and ironic towards community? And don't you need, in order to have a kind of a sense of belonging and a sense of community, to be not skeptical, not ironic to your community? Don't these things come in tension with one another?
Yes.
Tell me why not.
I don't have to say exactly why not, because I think part of the meaning of the adjective liberal is that we live with those kinds of tensions. That's why I spoke about a civil religion that wasn't overwhelming, that wasn't all consuming the way what I call the real religions are for many believers. We want a civil religion that still allows some distance. I think that, in fact, at least in this country, but I suspect in many other countries, the most intense relationships and feelings of solidarity come within the religious community, within the political party, within the philanthropic organization or mutual aid organization, and within the extended family. All of these are identity producing and identity reinforcing ways of life. But they have to coexist with each other. And if everybody is a true believer in whatever he truly believes, then without irony or skepticism of any sort, then we won't be able to live with each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, this in part goes to your liberal Judaism chapter, which is, which also could be applied to liberal forms of Christianity and whatnot, yeah. sort of the religious form of community in liberalism. I mean, one of the things that I think strikes me when thinking about religion, and especially liberal forms of religion in the United States, is that those congregations have been sort of steadily hollowing out, right? Like liberal Protestantism has been losing membership for years and years and years, whereas sort of evangelical Protestants, religious organizations have increased. I don't know what the numbers are on, you know, sort of Orthodox versus Reform Judaism. I think one of the worries, right, is that, you know, in the case of religious community, you know, the more you liberalize, the more secular you become, the more that sort of liberal form of religious community kind of fades away, and the more that you have a resurgence of a kind of traditionalist form of religion. Yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there has to be a kind of liberal traditionalism. I don't think being a liberal Jew or a liberal Christian implies rejecting the value of the history of the religious community and of the traditional doctrines of the community. I will be going this evening to a celebration of the Jewish holiday of Purim, which is in some ways a holiday that that liberals feel awkward about, since the story, which begins with the persecution, ends with triumphalism, which is not a liberal ending. But I will join with a congregation to celebrate this holiday, and we will talk about it, and I will express my my dislike of some aspects of the Purim story. But nonetheless, I will be there with the others celebrating the holiday. And I think some of the more, as you said, secularized religious groups, mainstream Protestant groups that have been losing members, are losing members because they lost that commitment to even a critical commitment to the tradition.
That's great. You also have chapter. We're coming to a close here, so we don't have time to tell. You have chapters on liberal feminism and liberalism in the academy, which
my chapter on liberal feminism was read by every woman in the It is the most collaborative effort. There's real pluralism represent that chapter.
That's right. Oh, it's great. Well, it's a great chapter. I wanted to just kind of come to a close by asking you some just sort of general questions about the future and about liberalism in America. Given the state of America, we're sort of a divided country. This is not it's a controversial statement. There's a lot of polarization. Are you optimistic about the liberal adjective today, or pessimistic? I mean, one way to put the question is, do you think we're more liberal today than we were 20, 30 years ago? And do you think we'll be more liberal still in 20, 30 years hence?
Well, I'm not sure optimistic or pessimistic is right. I am scared about the future of liberal democracy and liberal social democracy in the United States. And there are paradoxes in our recent history, because we have made great, there has been a lot of progress in civil rights for Blacks and Hispanics, in civil rights for gay men and women, in civil rights and an open economy for women. We've made real advances in that could be called liberal advances, but at the same time we have produced greater inequality. Despite those advances, we have produced greater inequality overall, which is a paradox, and one that I don't think enough people on the left, or the liberal left, are focused on, are addressing. What is the connection between these victories and the overall defeat? It is something I think about a lot, and if I live long enough, I hope to write something about that paradox.
That's great. Well, Michael, it's been a real pleasure to chat with you again, and thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.